Power Hour.
Coal. Oil. Natural gas.
Power Hour, the show where today's top energy experts break down today's top energy issues. No sound bites, no talking points, no nonsense, no BS, no softball questions, no vagueness, just in-depth analysis and ruthless clarity. Power Hour. Here's your host, Alex Epstein.
Welcome to Power Hour. I'm Alex Epstein. This week, we're going to talk about several important issues. One is subsidies, which we've talked about in previous episodes, but it can be a very confusing issue, so it's worth addressing from multiple angles. And we're also going to talk about the catastrophic climate change movement. And to discuss both of these issues, will be a very interesting guest. His name is Dr. Larry Bell. He's a professor of space architecture at the University of Houston, and he has a Forbes column where he writes about a remarkable array of issues. And I think the one thing in common that I really appreciate about it is that it's focused on the big picture. And being someone in the field of space who knows legends like Burt Rutan, he has a very good sense of just how to put all the different things together to reach an accurate conclusion. As you might imagine, when you're talking about launching spaceships and rockets, these are not things where you can afford to be wrong. So there's been an interesting movement in recent years of people in the field of space really criticizing people who create models that have to work, criticizing much of the methodology of the scientists, often so-called scientists, who claim that they can prove that there's catastrophic global warming. But as I said, Larry has many different interests, and we'll see in the show. I'm recording this after having recorded the episode, so I can say it's definitely worth listening to. I want to warn you, though, one thing, which is our fault, is there are a couple of times where the audio gets a little bit garbled. So we had a technical issue on our end. I think at every point you can understand it, so we're not going to cut any of it. But apologies to Larry and to you for that, and we'll get that worked out by next week. I think CIP's internet provider is not doing its level best, but we'll make sure to fix that. In any case, well worth listening to. So get ready for Larry Bell on climate change, on subsidies, and we'll see you on the other side.
Power Hour. Because what you don't know about energy can kill you. Here's Alex Epstein.
Joining us now on Power Hour is Larry Bell, who is a professor of space architecture at the University of Houston. Larry, welcome to Power Hour.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I wanted you on the show in particular this time because someone pointed out to me a great article you wrote on energy subsidies, and particularly the claim that the fossil fuel industry is massively subsidized, and were it not for that, and were it not for the woefully unsubsidized green energy industry, we'd all be using solar panels and windmills. So we'll get to that. But first, I want to ask you, how does a professor of space architecture become a prominent commentator both on the energy side of things? And also, you have a book called Climate of Corruption, which has to do with the global warming hook. So could you give us a little bit of background on you?
Well, yeah, I think generally what I do in my professional world is really connect the dots. You know, this space program is very widget-centered. You know, you think of as rocket scientists and so on. It's engineering-driven, and as it might well be. But what we do is really a connect the dots in terms of looking at the technology, but also looking at human requirements and mission requirements. So we're sort of big-picture people that have to understand a whole lot of the technical details. And I think that larger perspective is really what drives my writing. It's really looking for the connect the dots story behind the dots. And I write an opinion column twice a week, usually for Forbes in their online. I write occasionally for their print version as well. But I'm finding also that a lot of my space buddies, and some of them are quite well-known buddies, are also getting involved very much in the climate stuff, because climate is very dynamic. It's very much of a connect the dots issue, which is dominated by specialists that call themselves environmental scientists or climate scientists, and often those people have very, very narrow band perspectives based upon some little slim sliver of science that they do.
Yeah, well, let's explore that for a second, because I found it interesting that in recent years I've noticed Bert Rutan and Harrison Schmitt in particular come out with very extensive critiques, and Bert Rutan's has an enormous section on his website. And one interesting thing he discussed is the difference between what an engineer has to demonstrate with his claims and what these so-called climate modelers have to demonstrate. Are you familiar with that line of discussion?
Well, yes, I am, because I actually wrote an interview with him. I visited, my wife and I visited, he and his wife, Claire Deline, Idaho, last summer, and stayed with him for a couple of days. And you know, Bert's a marvelous guy, an amazing guy who has a very broad field of interests. And he's kind of like me. He's very compulsive when he gets involved in the subjects. And so, yes, I'm very much familiar with him. And if your listeners would click on just my name and his name, you'll pull up an interview I did with him on Forbes. That I think is quite illuminating. And he has contributed a great deal on the subject. And he would be a great example of one of the people I just mentioned.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that point in one more respect, I found it just very interesting how, you know, with a space mission, if you have a model, it really has to be right. Right, because you have a demonstrable outcome that if you don't get it, it's a big problem, and you have to demonstrate success. And yet, with these climate models, I mean, they have a demonstrable record of failure, and that doesn't seem to invalidate the expertise of those who continue to predict the future on their basis.
Yeah, Walt Cunningham, who's also a good friend of mine, Apollo 7 guy, commented that, in fact, on the jacket of my book, talking about how, you know, the science in space has to be right because it's a life and death matter. And there was a great deal of significance placed on science and the credibility of science back in the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo days in particular. Whereas he and others are lamenting the lack of scientific rigor that's brought to, and actually the politicization of science that we see represented in climate science. And it's quite a different matter, and I think that's one of the reasons a lot of the space people are very much offended by what they see passing under the rubric of science in climate.
Interesting. Well, for sure, I want to ask more about that later in the interview, and for sure discuss your book, Climate of Corruption. But let's jump into the title subject that we talked about, the issue of subsidies. And you have a recent article in your Forbes column. We'll give people the information a little later on how to access it, although if you just Google Larry Bell Forbes, you'll get it for sure. But you have a really interesting breakdown of the claim that the oil industry in particular, I think, is incredibly subsidized. And President Obama uses this figure over and over, about $4 billion. And you have this quote from him, $4 billion of your tax dollars, $4 billion subsidizes the oil industry every year. These companies are making record profits right now, tens of billions of dollars a year. And does anyone really think that Congress should give them another $4 billion this year? So where is this number coming from?
Well, you know, I mentioned that in the article, and I think rather than getting into it in too much depth, you can just Google that article, which came out just a couple of weeks ago. And then there's another one that I'm actually posting tomorrow, which has to do with natural gas, you know, as being represented by the Obama administration as being a bridge fuel to the future. And my article is titled Natural Gas Pipeline to Prosperity, Bridge Fuel to Nowhere, because I think so much of this is just propaganda that's put out to say that, well, you know, the fossil fuel gets, you know, so much subsidy, Whereas in fact, what they get are some tax breaks that all corporations get, except they get fewer of them. And if you took away those tax breaks for wind and solar, they'd die overnight. You know, they're totally dependent upon this taxpayer support. Not only the taxpayer support, but the mandates, for example, for ethanol consumption. And, these requirements that we use so much so-called renewable fuel, which is anything but renewable. If with wind power, for example, you have to have a spinning reserve because wind fluctuates. And it is often they quote the installed capacity, not actually what it produces, which is varies daily and it varies seasonally, and it varies with peak demand. It doesn't provide the power typically that you need when you need it. Same with solar. So we have so much misinformation about what that energy costs both the taxpayers in these subsidy burdens as well as ratepayers, because it gets intermingled with utility bills and of course the mandates which support these industries. And what the public doesn't understand is how incredibly limited the capacities of these so-called alternatives are. And then you look at the fact that with wind, as I mentioned, you have the spinning reserve, which is typically natural gas. So you're burning natural gas in the most inefficient way imaginable to balance out the grid when the wind flow is fluctuating. And you'd probably be better off just using natural gas and forgetting about the wind power. So there's so much misinformation. I think that the fossil companies are often reluctant to really defend themselves for fear they'll be ostracized for doing this. It's clearly true in the climate area where this cockamamie stuff about carbon pollution. I think the energy companies are pretty well browbeaten by media publicity to sort of go along with this nonsense.
Can you go into a little more depth into the extent to which solar and wind are subsidized? Because you mentioned that they would just die, and I don't think people generally have a very concrete idea. We hear subsidy, but it can be an abstract term. So what? When you get solar panels or when you hear about a wind farm, how much of that money is coming from you as a taxpayer, as a welfare handout?
Well, I don't have all the numbers right in front of me at this moment, but a subsidy can be looked at in according to several different definitions. There's a subsidy that comes in terms of actual tax money that goes into a company. It could be structured as a loan to companies, like we see the Solyndras of the world and some of these the contributions that are given to electric car companies and so on. Some of these are provided by the federal government. Some of them are provided by state governments. They take the form of, for example, tax relief, where a company doesn't have to pay taxes for a period of time as an incentive to locate in a particular area. There's cashbacks, kind of subsidies on cars that come from both states and the federal government. There are subsidies in the form of requirements that X percent of solar or wind power or renewable power must be provided by utility companies. Of course, those costs are passed back to the consumers, the ratepayers. There are subsidies in terms of, in the reverse, in the sense of relief provided to some companies that get special deals on their rates. We have subsidies in the form of military use of renewable power. You know, that it's coming out of taxpayer money to provide energy, electricity to air bases, you know, the ethanol fuel for aviation that the military is paying. It comes in many, many different forms. And I think probably the easiest way of thinking of a subsidy is that it's a way of so-called leveling the playing field, where the government picks the winners and losers, and more often they pick the losers.
Aaron, to me, the epitome of what's behind the subsidy is one of these mandates, these, you know, renewable portfolio standards or renewable mandates.
Yes.
Because ultimately, what the goal of all of these anti-CO2 movements are explicitly is eliminate something like 80% of fossil fuel use. So the subsidy is just kind of it's just one attempt at doing it. But ultimately, the goal is if you can't, like, let's say the subsidies aren't enough to really scale solar and wind, and they certainly aren't, then ultimately you're going to have to shove it down our throats, or at least ban what works and then force us to subsist on what doesn't.
Well, yes, and you mentioned the renewable standards is certainly an egregious type. The CO2 thing, you know, is just a tremendous lever that's been used, a tremendous hoax that's been used, because it's ideally suited to hammer fossils. And the suggestion is that, you know, the fossils, in this is the current story that the Obama administration is putting out, they've been putting out for some time, is that, well, we can use natural gas because it's lower in carbon dioxide. Actually, what they're trying to do is bludgeon coal out of business, and there's no secret about that, principally using regulation, using EPA and so on. So we're gonna promote natural gas now as a bridge to the future, and the future in their mind is you're gonna use solar and wind power and so on, which is a joke. Look what's happened in Europe. It's unreliable. It's pathetically limited. Very, very expensive. So we use carbon dioxide argument to attack coal. At the same time, we're seeing regulatory attacks on fracking for natural gas and drilling, and limitations on government land, which technically, you know, we taxpayers own. The growth in natural gas and drilling has really occurred on private lands. So it's really attacking all energy sources. And then you have the environmental organizations that virtually hate anything, any kind of energy source. You know, you have one or more organizations attacking virtually everything. You know, wind power, implodes the lungs of bats and chops up endangered birds, and solar fries tortoises in the desert. And they almost universally hate hydropower because of dams and damage to fish and so on. So there's nothing that's exempt. There's no energy source that's exempt. And then they laud the notion of, well, we're going to have electric cars that don't burn fuel. Yeah, but you know, where do you think the electricity comes from? You know, it comes from 42% comes from coal. You know, last I heard, I think it's about right, but 23% from natural gas. So no one is exempt. And meanwhile, the Keystone Pipeline is being held, you know, in hostage. And it's our energy philosophy and our national energy program is, if you want to call it that, is just a disaster.
Well, I like the term philosophy. I mean, I tend to be biased toward it because my background is in philosophy. But I think the point you stressed is so important about looking across every energy source. The environmentalists figure out a way to oppose it. I think if we look at what environmentalism is at root,
which is the view that human beings, it's wrong for human beings to impact the rest of nature. Well, every energy source involves converting some source of raw energy using, you know, some physical structure using mined materials. So you can always say, well, the mining has an impact and the materials have an impact. And what the trend is they simply oppose them. And plus the thing you use the energy for is to impact the rest of nature to improve your life. So those three pieces of it, all they have to do is oppose the most practical one and then move down the list. So it used to be, you know, the nuclear, and they pretty much gutted that. So now they're focused on coal, and then they're focused on gas. And, you know, they Sierra Club went beyond coal, and now they're beyond gas. And I think it's just so important to not grant them even that they support solar and wind. Those just happen to be practical for their purposes because they're impractical.
Yeah, and it's not just U.S., and I think a lot of this is nuttiness, and it's more than nuttiness. I think it's really diabolical. Is United Nations and the whole carbon cockamamie stuff, you know, largely grew out of the Green Party movement there, and particularly in Germany. You know, it's kind of grew up as an anti-nuclear movement, and then after the Cold War, kind of dissipated, then they switched to an anti-carbon, you know, climate sort of story. But we have this big wealth redistribution agenda of the United Nations, and it's really anti-prosperity. It's the notion that it's a zero-sum game mentality, that if one country, you know, country's rich, that it's taken away from other countries. And I think the experience is quite the opposite. I think prosperity, you know, in free market capitalism, that's born, you know, that is the father and mother of prosperity, is under attack. And where we see free markets, we see innovation. If there's any hope of having, you know, energy systems that transcend what we have today with the fossils and nuclear and so on, it'll come from innovation born from free markets, not from government invention. Government has never invented anything, and clearly not in the international scale either. So I think we're seeing these big wealth redistribution agendas, which the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change perfectly serves. And you look at the influence they have in China and these other countries, where it's a big deal for a scientist to be able to join IPCC and get their perks and get to travel to other countries and attend conferences, and suddenly they're part of the great international community of concerned people. And you mentioned, I think, to me that, you know, Dick Lindzen and others who, you know, the frightful lack of support for anyone that really takes a hard look at that science. You know, you have to drink the Kool-Aid. You have to support the Kool-Aid if you're going to get funded in climate science. Fortunately, I'm not in this situation, and I'm not connected with big oil, and they can't, you know, they can't really attack me for having any personal agenda in any of this. But I'm just sick and tired of seeing what it's doing to really dedicated scientists who can't get voices, can't get heard, can't get employed in universities because of the it's just not profitable. All the money flows from the government.
So this is obviously an issue you've studied a lot. Stepping back, how did you get started on this issue? Because now you've written a book, you write columns about it, but what was the beginning for you?
Well, I was kind of innocent. You know, actually, I was a very dear friend of mine, Fred Singer. He's become a dear friend. I knew him slightly at the time. Some years ago, he came to my office, and he's had an interest that we've shared for some time. And it really has nothing to do with climate. It has to do with missions to Mars, and most particularly looking at the moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, as potential staging areas for future Mars missions. And I won't get into all that, but it's rather esoteric, but I think important kind of opportunity that we both shared. And he was founder of the U.S. Weather Satellite Service. He's a space guy, and you know, basically he's a satellite guy, and from his background, marvelous background. And we were talking. He came to my office at the University of Houston some years ago, and in the course of conversation, it just totally unrelated to anything we were dealing with, he mentioned that the satellites were telling a different story about the global temperatures than the models were predicting, most particularly over the equator, the tropical troposphere. There would have all the models predicted a warm spot, and quite the opposite. The satellites were showing that there was no warm spot. In fact, it was somewhat the opposite. And so the observed data, particularly from satellites and balloons, the radio sondes, were telling a different story than what the surface temperatures and most particularly the models were saying. And I didn't think much about it at the time. You know, I'm kind of a one-track mind at one time. I operate in several tracks, but typically one at a time. And that just wasn't on my radar at the time. It was maybe a year or two later that I began to think about, well, maybe there's something we can learn from climate that we can apply to life support systems for spacecraft. And, you know, the kind of the spaceship Earth notion, I didn't think much about it at the time. I thought it was really a stretch, and I still do. But it kind of got me interested in looking at climate. And this is when Al Gore's book was out, and, you know, The Inconvenient Truth and so on, and people were talking about his movie. And so I began looking at climate. And the more I got into it, the more it didn't connect with what I was hearing reported, you know, and what I was seeing in the movie and in his book and so on. And I just became very suspicious because I thought, either I'm really out of step, either I'm missing some big picture, or this stuff's nuts. And I've concluded subsequently that it's nuts, that there's a great deal of misrepresentation of information. And I think it's egregious that the serious scientists haven't challenged this.
Well, I think the retort you'd get from the establishment, it's relevant that it's an establishment, is, well, you're not a climate scientist. This is the consensus of climate scientists, blah, blah, blah. You know, who are you to say that these guys are all wrong?
Well, even the consensus is a lie. If you look at, and I've written about this, and others have as well, that consensus, you know, a lot of it came out of the American Geophysical Union. I won't even dignify calling it a study. It was just, you know, somebody put in University of Illinois, put in a couple questions to their membership and about 3,000 membership, a couple of questions that most people would have answered yes to. And it had to do with, does climate have any, and does humankind have any influence on climate? Well, yeah, I mean, everything has some influence on everything. So it didn't say whether it's positive, negative, how much, whatever. And so it was just some very broad questions. And then out of the 3,000, I think about 300 people responded. And they finally culled it down to 70-some people who, and they said they had to have, I think, current science they had to have current grants or published literature or whatever. Well, one thing, you look at the published literature, this group has controlled the literature. You know, you can't get things published. You can't get the grants unless you're, again, drinking the Kool-Aid. So, and the questions were very, very broad, and it was anything but an embarrassingly stupid survey. And it's an example of how they find a number and they find some excuse to herald a number, whether it's energy subsidies or whether it's climate, and then it gets broadcast in the media endlessly, with no opportunity to get a voice, you know, looking seriously at where those numbers came from. And that's an example of how the media, I think, driven by sensationalism. Bad news sells a whole lot better than good news does in the media. And so much of this is used to support agendas. I don't care about climate. I never have. I care about how climate is used to drive agendas that are disastrous for our country and for our children and for our future. I don't care. I don't care. You know, the global warming is nonsense. The, you know, the climate's been warming and cooling for, you know, as long as climate has existed or as long as the planet has existed. There's no question that climate changes if, you know, only if totally. I don't know anyone that doesn't believe climate changes. I think most people probably believe that there's been some warming since the last little ice age, which is a good thing. The question is, what impact, what influence does carbon dioxide have relative to ocean cycles, relative to solar irradiance and sunspots, which I would submit are the much larger drivers. And whether if to the extent that carbon dioxide influences can be measured, and they never have been, you know, to what extent do they exist? Because we know that when there's been warming, it's driven carbon dioxide levels from the off-gassing of the oceans, just like a bottle of soda pop, where the carbon dioxide, atmospheric carbon dioxide levels increase because of warming. And you know, these are just basic fundamental things. And the public, I think, is becoming aware as you look at the Pew polls. You know, their climate alarmism is now like 21st, you know, priority for the public. They don't care about it. They shouldn't care about it.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that Obama recently felt compelled with this, you know, climate change plan to make it a big issue. And there's certainly a contingent, like the folks at 350.org, and I subscribe to a bunch of these organizations' mailing lists just to see what they're doing. And, I mean, they're very, very strongly pushing it, and they seem to have a good deal of influence because he did make it a priority, or at least he gave a speech about making it a priority.
There's trillions of dollars behind this thing. I mean, there is a huge amount of money behind this thing. You got, I don't know if it's a $5 billion a year climate and climate science industry, which is peanuts. I mean, that's the smallest of them. But you look at the subsidy incentives we've been talking about is a huge thing. You know, you have the environmental organizations pumping huge amounts of money into the propaganda machines, and there's just huge incentives. Without this, without all this nonsense, you know, what happens to the Obama cars? What happens to all these other agendas, which include the anti-drilling agendas? It's kind of, you know, if we take coal, for example, coal's got some big problems. It's got a history of people getting lung disease and some bad things that happen. But one thing is not an issue is carbon dioxide. You know, we can scrub out sulfur and we can scrub out a lot of the, you know, particulates, which actually cause cooling if you want to worry about the aerosols. We can scrub that stuff out, but to try to sequester the carbon dioxide, which makes no difference whatsoever, and try to find a place to store it. And that is an enormous expense, and that's the hammer they're using to kill coal. Unfortunately, you know, unfortunately, natural gas is killing coal already because of the tremendous advances in fracking and horizontal drilling and so on. So, coal is being hammered both by the Obama administration through regulations, through natural gas. Nuclear's got the same problem, of course, is price competitiveness with natural gas, and not to mention the fact they've created this problem with nuclear fuel storage, spent storage, and the government will, after we spent all this money on the storage facility at Yucca Mountain, you know, that's now on hold or dead or whatever. there was a time when Harry Reid wanted it, when Nevada wanted it. That was during the nuclear testing years. When that was before the casinos came in and replaced nuclear testing and nuclear for the revenue stream. So energy's under assault. I get really frustrated with the fact that when I write on a lot of different subjects for Forbes, the most important subject I write about, other than I think our disastrous defense policies and cutting back on missile defense and so on, but even more important, that is energy. And I find it really unfortunate that I get fewer readers on energy issues than I do on gun control. And I care about gun control. I think it's a symbolic issue. But I think where gun control is more of a symbolic issue in terms of, you know, our rights in the Constitution, energy is what fuels our lives. And putting taxes and burdens on energy is regressive. You want to be a do-gooder and care about poor people. The last thing you want to hurt is energy.
Yeah, it's got this interesting status because it's the most fundamental thing in an economy, and yet part of that is its influence is abstract unless someone knows how it connects to everything. And even you mentioned earlier this idea of the electric car, and people think that just electricity is something. And I've been shocked in the last year or two just by how many people just think the electric car is just powered by electricity and they don't know where it comes from. And I say, you know, it's a coal car, right? And they just had no idea. They just thought coal was something bad that we did for no reason to get miners sick.
Yeah. Do they possibly imagine that they're going to get new sunshine to power their cars at night to recharge their batteries? Isn't lighting used at night? The light bulb, isn't that a product of a daytime source? It's absolutely nutty. One of the things that I think could make probably more difference than anything, you can't change the laws of physics in terms of making wind power much better, or maybe solar power can be, you know, solar cells may improve slightly, and they're great to have if you're off the grid somewhere and you don't have a power line. I mean, that stuff's great. If there was some big breakthrough in battery tech and energy storage, now that would make a difference. It makes some difference in terms of being able to store, you know, photovoltaic. But solar energy is the most expensive energy we have, and second worst is offshore wind, which is corrosive and it, you know, not to mention environmentally, it, you know, kills lots of birds and so on. But these are not solutions. They're at best supplements, and I think pretty anemic ones, you know, to boot. And the notion that somehow we're going to populate the planet with windmills and solve our energy problems is really naive. And I think the media has contributed to that ignorance.
Going back to the global warming issue, you mentioned the issue of financial incentives. And this is an interesting one to me since it's definitely an issue. But at the same time, I'll hear the retort of, well, the fossil fuel industry has much, much more money than the environmental lobby. And then you could respond, well, the environmental lobby spends more of it on this kind of issue. But then there's also the question of how did it get started? Because once you have an establishment, there's all sorts of incentives for it to perpetuate itself, monetary and power and some of the things I think you discuss in your book. But how did this all... Why did it shake out this way that we're terrified of this tiny portion of the atmosphere increasing by a tiny amount and willing to shut down all of industrial civilization to stop that?
Well, it sounds like you're looking for a logical reason.
Well, no, I'm looking for a historical. There's you know, I'm not saying it's going to be a good reason, but just historically, this came about. Somehow, just like the eugenics movement came about, you know, many of the destructive movements in history.
Well, if you look at the politics, one of the interesting things to me is one of the biggest promoters, you know, we go back to the cap and trade thing in Kyoto. And this is when the Union of Concerned Scientists were switching from worried about a nuclear, you know, world to being, you know, a climate crisis. You know, less than half of a climate cycle after we were worrying about, you know, the next ice age coming and so on. Back in the late 70s, all of a sudden, here's 1988, and you got Gore convening this, this hearing, you know, that all of a sudden we have a climate crisis, and gee, it's called carbon dioxide. Before, there had never been any real studies on carbon dioxide and climate. It was suddenly a notion that the United Nations was going to seize upon this, and you had the IPCC being formed, and you had Kyoto. And the one of the big pushers in the U.S. behind this was Enron. Enron owned the largest natural gas pipeline outside of Russia. I mean, they were big on natural gas, and they couldn't compete with coal. Coal's beating their butt, and so they had made well on this acid rain nonsense that they tried to, and we spent $500 million over 10 years. You know, and the government did to, you know, just, you know, find acid rain. Now, again, industry, industrial revolution is killing the forest and so on. Well, you know, how many people have heard how that study came out? The reason you haven't heard is because it didn't come out the way the environmentalists wanted it to. They couldn't find a smoking gun. But they did manage to get cap and trade for sulfur dioxide and so on. And Enron was a big player in that. And they thought, hey, we could do the same thing with carbon dioxide. Except the problem was it wasn't a pollutant yet. And so they had this Project 88, which became the Clean Air Act. And suddenly we got to demonize carbon dioxide, got to have cap and trade. And Enron, you know, an internal memo said this is the best thing that ever happened to us outside of deregulating the natural gas industry. So, you know, you look at the players, whether you call Enron an energy company or just an energy exploiter, whatever you want to describe them. There's a lot of bad actors in this whole thing. And then you got, on top of that, you got the Green Party movement that was growing in Europe, and they were having a great deal of influence, and a lot of that was the attack on free market and free, you know, attack on capitalism. So you have all these convergent interests. You know, you have the environmental groups that grew up and had the effect of the Cold War. You've got the European Union trying to buy Russia to join the, you know, Kyoto, you know, offering them a chance to sell their Soviet era pollution credits and offering to get them into the give them a favored nation status, etc. And all of these converging interests, it was kind of a perfect storm that was supported by a whole lot of agendas. Did they all come together in a smoke-filled room and concoct this stuff? No, but it was convenient to many of them.
One more question on the history of this. You mentioned earlier about the Green Party in Europe, and in past shows we've talked about the international component of this, and just looking at the history of the Green Party, particularly in Germany, is horrifying because of its connection to the Nazis, among other things. Can you talk about the connection of the Green Party to the viewpoint of catastrophic global warming?
Well, you mentioned something just a moment ago, talking about eugenics, and how much of this was Malthusian. You know, the Malthusian notion that, you know, there's fixity. You know, there's the planet can only handle so many people, you know, and you have Ehrlich and his wife, the population bomb. You have Holden, you know, writing with Ehrlich and so on, that, you know, the worst, you know, humans are a virus, and we've got to find a way to control population. And we can put sterilants in the water, or we can charge luxury taxes for diapers, you know, all these different things. We, you know, the sterilization plan, you know, in India, in Japan, you know, if as a condition for food aid, we had Rachel Carson in the Silent Spring and the war against DDT, which is, I think, which was really a war against humanity, to eliminate, you know, DDT and and the tremendous explosion of malaria that's resulted from this, with millions dead. I think a lot of this is anti-human. It's there's just a marvelous book I've discovered by another space guy, a friend of mine, Robert Zubrin.
Yeah, he was on the show.
Of Despair.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show. It has really, yeah, I think it's really and important it's a, perspective.
And he pulls a lot of stuff together, you know, a lot of stuff I had known and had, but the amplification comes in some of the quotes that he's provided. And actually, I've been going through this recently. It's terrifying. Ironically, you talk about, you know, the so-called global warming deniers. Well, the irony is how much this matches the agenda of the Nazis in extermination and the Holocaust. It's absolutely a reversal of identities, where so much of this population control and this use of Darwin, you know, Darwin is a great naturalist, but the subject of, you know, some races are preferential to others, you know, that we're a human species, but there's different levels within the species. You talk about racism, rampant racism. It came out of the environmental groups and came out of the eugenicists, and scary stuff. And I think if you tell people this stuff, they'd be shocked. They say, well, that can't be true. It can't be that ugly. Well, what's that ugly?
Yeah, and definitely Merchants of Despair by Zubrin, I think, really, really puts that together. And it's helpful because he takes multiple movements and shows that we're going through the same pattern today. And it really drives home that it's possible to fall prey to these movements, and we shouldn't think ourselves above doing something destructive. We're heading toward the end of the interview, so...
Well, you think, you know, the... Okay.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say this. You mentioned global warming. You know, Zubrin talks about, I think, you know, and again, it's a good book. It's got lots of stuff in it, but there's so many more chapters can be written on the global warming component of that, which is, I think also directly related to all the things we're talking about, where the global warming becomes another attack on something that we desperately need, that has an impact upon free markets, that has an impact upon and control and all of this. Russia and the Berlin Wall came down to work with their space program and nuclear sound, et cetera. And I think it's about control. I think it's about, you know, big government. I think it's about science things. I think these people are just useful fools. I don't think they realize that their partner and parents don't care, that they're being manipulated by much larger forces. And this goes a lot higher than any of us want to imagine.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right, let's make sure listeners know where to follow you. Where can you be found online?
Well, if you Google Larry Bell, Forbes, you'll pull up, you know, and probably hundreds of pages of stuff. It'll pull up to my articles and quite a long list. I've written in the last over a little over 2 years. I've written over a couple hundred of them. I try to make them very substantive and well documented and so on. If you pull up an article and you click on right next to my picture, there's a thing that says follow me. It'll send you links to all my articles, you know, as they come out. And that's the best way to reach me. I don't go on Facebook and these other things. It's because I'm already captive to, you know, the internet enough, and I just don't don't need Twitter and all the other stuff. But if you just click on that, you'll be able to get my articles.
All right, great. Well, any final thoughts you want to share?
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you. I know you've had some really great commentators, and I feel very honored to be listed among them, among your in your venue. But I enjoyed this. I think the readers and listeners and audience needs to keep their eye on the big picture. And you get so lost in the minutiae, you get so lost in the alarmist little statements that come out regularly about this is the warmest day since yada yada yada, whatever. And look at the large picture. And people say, well, follow the money, but I'd say even more than that, follow the control.
Fascinating. Well, thanks so much, Larry, for coming on the program.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Larry Bell for being on the show. A couple of final thoughts. At the end, especially, although implicitly during the whole episode, he emphasized the issue of the big picture. And this is a theme that we stress a lot at Center for Industrial Progress. I think from his angle, it comes from being involved in different things in space where you have to get a conclusion that integrates every variable. If you ignore certain variables, if you look at things out of context, you will simply fail in your mission. And my obsession with big picture comes in part from having a background in philosophy, which is really, from a certain perspective, the study of the big picture and puts you on the premise of what is everything relevant to this situation. So if we see something like record wildfires in Colorado and therefore Obama climate plan necessary, the feeling is, whoa, that doesn't follow in philosophy. That's a non sequitur. I need so much more information to know that this kind of plan is necessary. I mean, what is the claim of the plan? What are the benefits of the plan? What are the hazards of the plan? How does the plan integrate with things like individual rights? And then if you look at the weather event, what is the implication of a weather record? I mean, obviously, there's always going to be a record of something. Is there an abnormal number of records? Is warming that? There's all these things that you would need to think about it. Now, really, the way to have the big picture, though, is how you experience these bizarre non sequiturs. You experience them as this is a complete violation of the big picture. You don't even know where to start. But then positively, what it leads to is asking fundamental questions to get to the root of the issue. So if we want to look at, okay, what's the state of our, of human beings, of human activities in our climate, you look at things like, well, is our climate overall safer or more dangerous? Now, that's not the only question, but that's an important big picture question that any kind of model would have to grapple with. And as we've discussed on the show, climate-related deaths have been down 98%, which means a factor of 50 since we started major CO2 emissions. And that one fact by itself encompasses so many little disasters. And what it says is that the amount of disasters and how disastrous they are, the net of that has been so much lower, and obviously due to human activity, unless we just think that nature just decided to really, really love us much more in the last 80 years, which seems highly unlikely. And if you integrate that with previous weather patterns, I think it's justified to think, okay, human beings had an impact. But if we don't start with the big picture questions, and that means the basic questions about any given phenomena in relation to human life, if we don't do that, we are just going to be immersed in mental garbage and people who can prove anything, because they just bring out, there's an unlimited number of facts, so you just bring out one thing out of context that seems negative, and then you draw a conclusion that doesn't follow, and you can prove anything. So this is why we have the idea of logical fallacies, and why so much of logic is starting out with the right question. So I'm really glad Larry brought that up, and hopefully that elaboration is helpful in terms of understanding the right methodology. Now, one other thought is on the, it's really important, I think, to understand how destructive movements work. Now, it's first point is we know for certain that destructive false movements do exist across time. So when someone says, hey, I think this movement, I think there's a hoax. I don't always use the term hoax, but I think that there's a phenomenon of mass delusion or mass distortion. You have to acknowledge that is a possibility. If you don't, you're denying a real possibility inherent in human nature and basically saying self-exclusion. Oh, well, we couldn't possibly make that mistake. And I think that's very naive. And most of the people who think that have no idea what the history is. But then it's important to understand, well, how do these things work? And if you read my book, Fossil Fuels Improve the Planet, at the end of it, there are a couple articles by Eric Dennis, who's a senior fellow at CIP, and he's got some really interesting explanations of the mechanisms of how it's possible for so many people to be so wrong, for the public impression to be that there's this consensus when there's not, or for a consensus to be wrong. So it's really important to understand, particularly if you're not an expert in all the details. But one thing to think about with this is thinking of the modern establishment, and Ayn Rand has a great article on this called The Establishing of an Establishment in the book Philosophy Who Needs It. You have to think of the modern educational system as a monopoly. And so it's an established monopoly by the government, which means that there's a single source of funding and control that has its tentacles in almost every institution of higher education. And the significance of that cannot be overstated, because once they're giving money, once they are in the position of deciding what constitutes an acceptable position and what doesn't. And once you're in that position, then you have an amount of thought control. And if you look at the history of what happens when a government grants a coercive monopoly, when it gives an exclusive charter to some company, well, that is an enormous suppression of innovation and finding out what works best. And if that's true of a company, it's certainly true of a thought institution, because it is essentially saying competition is bad, because there's a whole group of people who are institutionalized, and their membership in the institution, their livelihood depends on their conclusion being vindicated. So there's an enormous amount of hostility toward competition. Now, in the market, a lot of businesses don't like competition. I mean, it's not that fun to be doing something that's working well, and then it stops working. But guess what? When you have freedom of competition, you have no choice. So you have to accept that. But when you have a monopoly, when you've got a monopoly establishment that can effectively say, this is the official position, look, we all agree, all of us who are participating in this enterprise are right, this is the opposite of thought. So we have a thought monopoly, which is the antithesis of thought. So what needs to happen ultimately is the government needs to get out of education. There is no way for the government to be involved in education. For the government to be involved in education, which means the government decides what qualifies as a good idea, what qualifies as a bad idea, what qualifies as true, what qualifies as false. As soon as it does that, it is engaged in thought control, and it will have an enormous, enormously destructive impact. And there's no accident that these other corruptions of science, like the eugenics movement, had enormous government official components to them. So separation of science, separation of education and state, as advocate of laissez-faire capitalism, that's considered one of my more controversial positions, but I consider it one of my less controversial positions, because the government is engaged in thought control out of necessity, even if it's trying to do the right thing. And it tends to attract people who aren't trying to do the right thing. So that's my conclusion. But I want you to think about just not just the conclusion, but the phenomenon of a monopoly on ideas, a monopoly, claiming a monopoly on the truth, because it's exactly the same as in a business context where the government is basically saying, well, we have a monopoly on the best way to do things. And no, you don't. You're not going to discover the best way to do things without competition. You're going to suppress the best things enormously. And that means the system that you have will be wildly inferior to what you could have under a free system. So I hope that's helpful. That's my final thought for the day. As always, if you have any questions, comments, love mail, or hate mail, email me at alex@industrialprogress.net. Make sure to check out facebook.com/ilovefossilfuels, facebook.com/thepursuitofenergy. That's my own Facebook page. We've had a lot of action there recently, and we will have more to come. So make sure, if you want to do one thing this week to promote us, just get your friends to know about the I Love Fossil Fuels page. We're almost at 2,000 with that now. It's been growing a lot recently. We want to get to 10,000 and then beyond, so we can start competing with the green pieces of the world. Next week, we will be back with another great topic, another great guest. But until then, I'm Alex Epstein. This has been Power Hour.
Power Hour. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of energy. Power Hour. The antidote to shallow thinking about energy issues.